Hello and welcome to the March 8th edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I am Anthony Bardaway and doing this one by myself. This is being released on March 8th, which is Women's Day, so happy Women's Day. If I was better organized, this would be a show about feminist topics, but I am not, so it is not. Instead, most of this episode will be dealing with the many, many topics going on in Europe right now, throughout the European Union and outside of it. There's a lot of news stories that are relevant to Ukraine. So this episode will be mostly a news roundup of that long list of topics in Europe. But first, we'll do our combat update. And to start off, once again, another Russian ship was sunk by Ukrainian suicide naval drones. On March 5th, there was news of explosions around the Kerch Strait Bridge, specifically pretty close to the city of Kerch. There was explosions reported, and this turned out to be the patrol ship, the Sergei Kotov. So once again, the Black Sea Fleet continues to dwindle smaller and smaller. As for what's happening in the ground battle, following the Russian capture of Avdiivka, their advance away from Avdiivka has continued at a pretty rapid clip. Many of the villages in the immediate outskirts of Avdiivka have already been captured by the Russians, and the fighting there is currently over Tanninka, Orlivka, Semenivka, Berdichi, and Novokalinova. Of these, Tanninka is caught in something of a cauldron. It is being surrounded by three sides, but this is a relatively small village, just a couple of streets, and there is plenty of room to navigate out of that cauldron when the time comes. As of right now, the Russians are starting to reach something of a natural barrier point in that a lot of this area that they're advancing into now is either along some of these rivers and lakes in the area or are going to reach that point relatively soon. So some kind of natural barrier can help to slow down the advance that is happening there, which has, like I said, been, by the standards of the extremely slow pace of the war for the last year, pretty rapid. Meanwhile, their largest buildup still continues to be in the Kupiansk direction, but again, nothing has come of that quite yet. And as we've covered in the last few episodes about this, the number one reason why Ukrainians are having to withdraw from various positions is they just do not have the ammunition, especially artillery shells. They can't shoot back, so they hold as long as they can, using suicide drones as an alternative to artillery shells. But at least in the Avdiivka area, not as much of a problem in other areas, but still a problem, falling back when that is no longer sustainable. Which brings us into our first Europe topic. A few weeks ago, Czechia, or the Czech Republic as sometimes still called, but they prefer Czechia, has been putting together a coalition of countries to purchase 800,000 rounds of artillery shells. They're rounding up the money for it from throughout Europe, and they report that now all the money is there. They have the money, they have the seller, and from now it's just a matter of meeting together to figure out the logistics of getting those rounds from where they are to where they need to be. Now, where they're coming from is still technically a mystery. There are some guesses, probably a mixture of Pakistan, maybe India, maybe Bosnia. It is not especially transparent where these rounds are coming from, but they have the rounds, which means that in a few weeks, the delivery will take place, and another, I don't know how much time after that, they will find their way into the hands of Ukrainian defenders. This is extremely important because the time is running out on the Ukrainian artillery shell supply. It is still there, but it is being quickly dwindling and being very, very heavily rationed. So another 800,000 rounds will buy a lot of time for Ukraine to then find other sources of ammunition. On this topic in the U.S., not in Europe, Congress is continuing to be deadlocked over the Ukraine aid issue and, frankly, of every single issue. There's not much happening, not much going to happen. The only thing that they seem to be able to vote in favor of is their own vacation time. But there are currently two separate discharge petitions going on in the House of Representatives that would force a vote. So currently, Speaker Johnson in the House of Representatives is refusing for there to even be a vote on Ukraine aid, and these petitions will allow the vote to go to the floor without his say-so, one by Democrats, one by Republicans, but it stands to reason that they're coordinating their efforts here. On the Republican side, the issue is being spearheaded by Brian Fitzpatrick, who represents the northern suburbs of Philadelphia. Fitzpatrick is about as moderate as a Republican can come in the House of Representatives, by which I mean that he was the only Republican to attend a ceremony marking the anniversary of the January 6th attempted coup. So between this Czech-led supply, and hopefully if these petitions go through in the House of Representatives, American supply being restarted, some of these problems with ammunition can be resolved. But in the fastest time frame, that's still maybe a month away to even begin fixing that process. And that can be a very, very long time for the soldiers in the trenches to go without covering fire from artillery. To break up this good news with some bad news, looking at Germany now, Prime Minister Scholz has always not been good at communicating on Ukraine. Especially within the last year, German aid to Ukraine has been much more reliable, and as a part of the 2024 budget, there is a substantial amount of financial aid being sent to Ukraine via Germany. But he's always been so quick to have to put a foot in his mouth, Prime Minister Scholz, I mean. And there was another example of this, where when describing why Germany would not be sending Taurus missiles to Ukraine, he let loose with a lot of dumb stuff. So for the background information here, these Taurus missiles are long-range missiles that Ukraine believes are capable of destroying the Kerch Strait Bridge, severing Crimea from Russia by getting rid of the main rail and road line. This would make military supplies along the southern front much more difficult to get for the Russians, as well as making Crimea overall a much less attractive location for the Russians to hold on to. Germany has been refusing to send these Taurus missiles. This is not just a German problem. The Americans, the Brits, everyone has been sending lower grade missiles than what has been asked for out of the same concern, which is that Germany is very concerned about Ukraine using missiles against the actual borders of the Russian Federation. Nobody wants the weapons that they are supplying Ukraine to be used to target Moscow, St. Petersburg, Belgorod, anything like that, because they see it as an escalation of the war. It's very silly. There's no reason why that would be the thing and not anything else. Ukraine has already struck into Russia many, many times. It being done with weapons supplied by our Western partners would not change anything in that, but that is not how Western capitals have been seeing that. But anyway, so as a part of this speech, he said that they could not send Taurus missiles because it required sending German soldiers into Ukraine to use it, and by sending German soldiers into Ukraine, they would become directly party to the war as opposed to just doing aid and supply. Which is plainly ridiculous. They can teach Ukrainians to use this weapon the same that they can teach Ukrainians to use any other weapon, including quite advanced and complicated ones. He then put his foot in his mouth even further by releasing the information that British soldiers are on the ground in Ukraine to help with targeting and the use of British weaponry. Prime Minister Sunak did confirm this, but this was something that was being held as something of a secret. So having a NATO ally divulge a secret like this is a very serious diplomatic problem. Of course, the Brits then said that the soldiers were only there for some training support. So just because there are a handful of British soldiers in Ukraine does not mean that Germans would have to do the same. But while Germany withdraws and makes things more difficult for everybody, including one polling result that shows that the German populace is becoming increasingly hesitant about supply and aid to Ukraine, even though, like I said, the aid has increased, the German public has been losing its appetite for it, mainly because of government framing about how if they do anything more than they're currently doing, they're inviting World War III and some nonsense about how they cannot be the ones to attack Russia, and there's a whole lot of twisted political and historical psychological approaches to why Germany has been so odd during this entire conflict. But anyway, moving on, there's so much to say that's been said many times on this podcast and will be said many more times on this podcast because it will be a continuing issue. But yes, moving on. France. Those who are following the news were probably taken quite aback by some of the statements by French President Emmanuel Macron this week. So I said in the previous little segment there that no countries are happy with the thought of their weaponry being used against targets on Russian soil. France seems to be the exception here, at least according to statements made by Macron, though this hasn't transferred into any actual policy yet. In a series of speeches, both to the press, in public, as well as a meeting with the opposition, he's made various statements of the fact, but he said that Russia cannot and should not win the war, and that there are no more red lines and no more conditions on what aid should be given to Ukraine. This is further expanded by him saying that this could possibly include France sending soldiers to Ukraine to join the war against Russia. And shortly after Macron made these statements about possibly sending Russian soldiers to Ukraine, the leader of Czechia, Petro Pavel, he backed up these statements by saying, yes, this should be something we should be talking about and considering to do in the future. At that meeting with the opposition parties, where he said that there should be no more red lines, he said that there should be a plan in place that for when France could introduce soldiers to the conflict, and it seemed to mostly based around if Russia is directly threatening Kyiv or Odessa. Of course, Kharkiv is larger than Odessa and was very much threatened already, as well as Kyiv, obviously, but we don't know where this is a new policy, so we don't have to look at the past in that regard. Most of the rest of Europe, besides Czechia, have said that no, we're not going to do this. But this raises a very important issue here, which is that this entire conflict, the United States and Europe have been very quick to say the things that they would not do. They would not send soldiers. They would not allow their equipment to be used against targets on Russian soil. Every single new type of weapon system that is sent to Ukraine comes with months of agonizing about how it can be used, how it should be used, the limitations of using it. It's all very out in the open, very explicit, and a sign of weakness. A sign of weakness that Russia interprets as such. Russia prefers to have strategic ambiguity. They do not let it be known what their red lines are. They do not let it be known what the conditions for various things will be. They present pretty much the maximum possible consequences to everything. They have made numerous threats of using nuclear war. Not directly out of Putin's mouth anyway, but out of the approved propaganda networks. Everything that Russia does, they hold the nuclear gun to the Earth's head, saying, if you do not give us what we want, then we might blow up the world. And we all know they're not going to do that. There was threats that Russia would resort to nuclear weaponry if Ukraine retook Kherson. Kherson was formally annexed by the Russian Federation according to their constitution, and they said that they would use nuclear weapons in order to protect their constitutional territory, which again includes Kherson. Kherson is taken, no nukes. And that's just one example. Russia is able to keep the West afraid of what they might do, while the West is telling Russia explicitly what it will not do, which means that Russia knows what places it can push for, it knows how to take advantage of insecurities, it knows all the movement that is capable of taking without there being any response from the West in order to correct it. Even in the buildup to this war, Russia just simply lied about all of its intentions, about all of its demands, about absolutely everything. So everyone was left to kind of make up their own version of what Russia was trying to do. And this strategic ambiguity completely thrown off the preparation of the defense in the war. Russia's good at this. The West is very bad at this. So to have Macron come up with these kind of vaguely worded threats of France entering the war without strict definitions of when that would happen, if it would happen at all, that is the kind of game that actually harms Russia, and they've responded in turn. Russia has shown a lot of fear of France doing this. Do I think France will do this? I don't think so. It's still very unpopular. The rest of NATO is saying no way to it. So France going on its own is not as likely. However, by having the strategic ambiguity, they're able to scare Russia away from certain things. And, well, one thing with France and its military is, if you know French nuclear doctrine, their nuclear doctrine is far more aggressive than any nuclear doctrine anywhere in the world. The French nuclear doctrine allows for preventative first strike, which is not something that most nuclear armed countries have as part of their policy. The Russian policy is very strictly defensive, and not just as it goes towards Russian territory, but the Russian state, essentially. They will use nuclear weapons in the event of a threat to the existence of the Russian state. And even so much as occupying parts of Russian territory does not necessarily threaten the Russian state, so within the rule book of Russian nuclear use, it's still far lighter on the touch than definitely the French. So to have that option in while Russia is threatening nukes all the time, to have a country that by its very nature of its doctrine is constantly threatening nukes, that also... Russia has been backed down from nuclear threats before, and this may be the thing that does it again. But anyway, France has been taking other bold stances. We'll be getting into Moldova a bit later, but they have entered into security cooperation with Moldova. Within French domestic politics, Macron has started really, rhetorically at least, cracking down on pro-Russian elements in the opposition. This goes for both the far right and the far left of the French opposition have both been quite friendly to Russia, and he really kind of took them to task on that. So what actual policy, what actual real-world material consequences come from this rhetorical shift by Emmanuel Macron, we have yet to see. But if we compare it to his responses to the Russians in the early phases of the full-scale invasion, where he was constantly trying to reassure Russia, where he was constantly trying to reach out to Putin with appeals to logic, with his really pretending that the Russians had any point at all in what they were doing. He has severely turned around on that from being one of the Western leaders who was possibly the softest on Russia to now being definitely, again, just rhetorically, not necessarily policy, the harshest. So we'll see where France goes with this, but it is very interesting, this shift in the much more assertive France, what that means. They have always seen themselves as a center of Europe, of course, along with Germany. That's the two largest economies in the European Union. Within the European Union, they have the strongest military. And they've always wanted more say in that security infrastructure than they have in the past. So now is the moment where a French-led European order, at least in security terms, is possible if Macron plays his cards right. Which takes us to our next topic, speaking of the European security infrastructure. Sweden has finally joined NATO. This was an arduous process of trying to get through political hurdles. Turkey and Hungary were the last holdouts on supporting Sweden's ascension. Turkey made some kind of deal to allow it. Hungary, being Hungary, kept complaining and demanding more things and being obnoxious until they eventually gave in after being bribed. But at the end of this process, Sweden now formally in NATO, along with Finland, who had joined earlier. Both of these countries with rather long-running diplomatic histories of being neutral, joining a military alliance as NATO is a very, very big deal. Sweden had been neutral since the Napoleonic Wars. And though its full neutrality status was eroded in the 2000s when it joined into various security treaties and such with neighboring countries and began cooperating with NATO, it to now be officially aligned with NATO is... since, again, like I said, since 1812, this trend of Swedish diplomatic neutrality, though weaker in recent years, goes back to 1812. All because Russia decided to launch a war to keep NATO away from its borders, which, as we've gone over many times, is not why they did it. It's nonsense, but this is further proof of why that's not why they did it. Russia barely had anything to say about Finland and Sweden joining NATO. They had some minor grumbling, but didn't do anything about it. They certainly did not invade Finland. So maybe when Russia said that it was invading in order to keep Ukraine out of NATO, they were lying because they don't care that much. But as this is happening with Finland and Sweden joining NATO, that means the Baltic Sea is now essentially a NATO lake. Russia still has the port enclave of Kaliningrad. And of course, its second largest city, St. Petersburg, is on the Baltic Sea, but otherwise they are completely hemmed in. In the event of a conflict with NATO, the Baltic Sea will be completely unusable for the Russian Navy, just as the Black Sea is currently unusable for the Russian Navy. The Baltic Sea and the Black Sea are the two areas that the Russians have most concern about themselves with as far as their navies go. Some of their larger ships are with the Baltic Fleet. And now, if you would go back in time and tell, you know, Russians of wars past that they would be losing both the Baltic and Black Seas because of a stupid bid to capture Ukraine, well, they might understand that. They've made stupid ideas in their own times as well. But in order to bring Ukraine back into the fold, they gave up both of their seas. That's a historical change right there. This leaves them, of course, with the Pacific, where they're always going to just be second fiddle to China, and I guess the Arctic Ocean. And in this world of increased global warming, the Arctic Ocean has been much more ocean than in the past, much less ice there. So this whole thing of warm water ports, well, you got those on the Arctic as well, it seems. But yeah. Navally hemmed in, not much for them to do about it. In our next topic, I guess going a little bit south on the Baltic coast, Poland. We've been talking in many, many episodes about the various updates of the story of the Polish farmers blockading the border with Ukraine in order to protest against the entrance of Ukrainian grain onto Polish markets. Of course, at first, that being taken off of the Polish market. To describe every twist and turn in the story, it's spread out over several episodes. So basically, the Polish farmers are mad at the possibility of Ukrainian grain decreasing grain prices and therefore them losing money, and therefore have been blocking the border with Ukraine in order to protest against this. Recently, these protests have been getting a lot larger. These protests have also been happening in Warsaw itself, the capital of Poland, where there were even clashes between some of these farmer protesters and the Polish riot police. This whole thing is very quickly spiraling out of hand, with the border shutdowns becoming more extensive, to where they're now stopping trains and everything else, and dumping and ruining grain, and even stopping passenger traffic on a number of occasions. It is now becoming a bigger problem outside of just this border area, again into Warsaw. In order to try to solve this political crisis, Polish leader Donald Tusk has been making a lot of deals to potentially end these protests, and none of them have worked, and a lot of them barely survive longer than a few days of being on the table. One of the more demonstrative deals that were turned down was saying that Poland would also be blocking import from Russia and Belarus because there's nothing special about Ukrainian grain that would decrease prices that Belarusian and Russian grain would not. So if the farmers are truly concerned with this issue of dumping, then why not block Russian products as well? This is obviously pretty solid logic, and that is why it was turned down, to the point where I didn't even see it talked about that much. It was just not treated to be particularly serious for longer than about a week. Because, yes, Russia and Belarus are still trading with Poland pretty extensively. None of the sanctions on Russia have anything to do with agricultural products. The decision was made that they do not want global food prices to go up, which is something that would happen if a Russian grain and fertilizer and things like that were part of the sanctions, which would then have, you know, political consequences in many places, food being expensive, exacerbates all kinds of political problems that people wanted to avoid. But with Poland, they do want these prices to be high, so they offer to again have this blocking and was turned down. And this is kind of goes in parcel with another story I heard recently. I forget who I heard, what journalists this information comes from. It was credible at the time, so I'm not just making it up. But basically, the investigative journalists went to video these trains of Russian grain coming into Poland to demonstrate that the problem is not Ukraine. And they were stopped by police, and when told that, no, we know that this is Russian grain, there's the police then responded with, oh, who told you that? Who's telling you that Russian grain is entering Poland? Like, it was some kind of secret, like this is all black market stuff and not just completely public information that just needed to be publicized a bit more because of the disinformation that Ukraine was the problem. So it's very obvious that within these farmer protests, although it is based on the usual protectionist concerns, every single episode we talk about this, I try to say that protectionism is a very normal thing, especially when it comes to agriculture, and especially agriculture in the European Union. Trying to protect farmers' livelihoods is always a very big political topic. However, when offered to do that in such a way that could have harmed Russia, they said no, which further backs up the very obvious thesis that these protests are being aggravated by Russia. And quite frankly, it is currently early March. It is sowing season. This ought to be a very busy time for farmers. They should be planting right now. So how is it that so many more people come to farmers' protests at the time of year when farmers most need to be at work? Maybe they're not even farmers. Or maybe they're just hiring someone else to do it while they're away. Maybe Ukrainians. And moving on to our next topic here. In Greece, so way down south in Greece, from the Baltic Sea to the Aegean Sea. The Greek Prime Minister, and forgive me for the pronunciation, I'm not great on pronunciation in many cases, Greeks, you have complicated names, I'm sorry, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, I'm sure that's fine, was visiting Odessa, where he held a joint press conference with Zelensky at the Transfiguration Cathedral, which was the cathedral that we talked about last summer. It was hit by a Russian cruise missile. I went there later, took photos. I believe I posted them in the Patreon. But the Transfiguration Cathedral was the main cathedral of the city, Orthodox, that was destroyed. Not just completely destroyed, but significantly damaged by Russia. And they'd had their press meeting there. After that, they went on to the Odessa port. And while they're at Odessa port, there was an air raid siren, which they then very quickly went to shelter. However, when the Russian missile did hit, it hit within, I've seen various numbers, from 150 to 300 meters away from them. So Zelensky and the Prime Minister of Greece were between 150 and 300 meters away from being killed by Russia. This obviously would have been a very big deal if it happened. Zelensky is a very important figure, and though his loss would be a tragedy, there would be people who could step into his shoes. But in the case of Greece, this is, again, a NATO member, and a NATO member having its prime minister being killed in a military action, well, World War I started for a smaller reason than that. So that's just the news story there. We came very, very close to a big international incident of Greece being open war being declared on Greece by Russia. But I think it's interesting to point out here why they were in Odessa. Usually when foreign dignitaries come to Ukraine, they go to Kyiv. It is the capital, after all, and it's safer than Odessa. Well, Odessa is actually extremely important to Greece as a country and Greeks as a people. Historically, through the 19th century, when I talk about Odessa, it's often in its Jewish context, but at the same time, it was also a very heavily Greek city. There were a lot of Greeks living there, and the culture of the city was also very heavily influenced by these Greeks. In fact, if you go back far enough in time to the Iron Age, there was a Greek colony on the site of Odessa. And though the actual site of Odessos was significantly further south, more in Bulgaria, when the Russian Empire wanted to expand on the existing settlements in the area of now Odessa, they decided to name it Odessos to kind of attach it to its Greek legacy. So all these cities in southern Ukraine, Odessa, Sevastopol, Mariupol, they have Greek names in order to attach them to the Greek cultural legacy. But Odessa was one of the bigger sites of these Greeks, to the point where the Greek society that was conspiring against the Ottoman Turks in order to fight for Greek independence, it started and operated out of Odessa. So Odessa really is the birthplace of modern Greece. So that is why they were in Odessa. It is culturally, historically, extremely important to Greece, and that is why it is better to have it there than Kyiv. There's not much importance there for the story, but I think it is interesting historically. In our last European story here, we're going to Moldova. I said in the French section that that France had agreed to sign a security cooperation deal with Moldova, and there's very good reason for why it happened now. So a meeting of the Congress of Transnistria, and again, this is another topic that we've been kind of covering continuously more than some others. Transnistria is a region within Moldova that was occupied by the Soviet military in the breakup of the Soviet Union and formed a kind of Soviet rump state in the east of Moldova to the east of the Dniester River. So Transnistria on the other side of the Dniester. Demographically, it's about one-third Russian, one-third Ukrainian, one-third Moldovan-Romanian, give or take, you know, but good rule of thumb on that. That is loyal to Russia. There's a Russian military garrison there, and it is the same deal as what was going on in Abkhazia and South Ossetia in Georgia, these kind of fake countries that were engineered by Russia in order to maintain a Russian presence in various former Soviet republics. So Transnistria, however, is probably the most anodyne of all these examples in that, for all intents and purposes, a Transnistrian, nothing was really differentiating them from a Moldovan, and it's pretty peaceful all around. It's not like in Georgia, where every once in a while the Russian military would move the fence forward a couple meters. This problem with Transnistria has mostly been contained. But anyway, so the Transnistrian government, or Congress, met to have a meeting to complain about various measures taken by the Moldovan government that negatively impacted them. Most importantly, had to deal with an act by the Moldovan government that when goods enter Moldovan territory on their way to Transnistria, Moldova will collect a tariff on that, like the import duties. Pretty logical. Goods entering Moldova, Moldova determines the trade policy. But for the last, since 1991, that hasn't been the case. So Transnistria saw this as them having to pay a new tax that they would not previously have had to pay, which is when this Congress made an appeal to Russia to help mediate this problem, is the lightest way to put it. The most soft way to look at this is that Moldova would receive some kind of political or diplomatic economic pressure from Russia to reverse this decision if the cost of keeping it could be higher than the cost of not keeping it. That is, of course, like I said, the lightest way to look at this. The harder way to look at this, however, is that this was seen by an attempt by Transnistria to get Russia to try to annex them. as was the case with Donbass and what led to the war, when the Russian puppet authorities in the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republic would appeal to Russia to annex them formally into the Russian Federation, which meant that Russia would have to come in and protect them with military force. That is how the Russians paint the beginning of the war on their side. And for their part, the Russian government certainly wanted to keep this narrative going, that it would be very similar to Donetsk in the Luhansk People's Republic. So Lavrov made the claim that, quote, "The regime that has settled in Chisinau and which is following in the footsteps of the Kiev regime, sweeping away everything Russian, discriminating against the Russian language in all of its spheres." Again, using the exact same logic that they were using in the lead up to the invasion of Ukraine about Moldova. And this is, of course, all very deliberate. Russia wants to make it known that if they had the capability of invading Moldova, they would. And the only thing that's stopping them at the moment is the Ukrainian military. Russia cannot invade Moldova because they have no access to Moldova. Ukraine shares a border with Russia. Moldova does not. Now, the rhetoric around the Transnistria issue has been building over the last 2 years. Transnistria, for its part, has mostly tried to keep quiet. They know that they are in a weak position. They have, at most, 1,500 soldiers on their territory that are very poorly equipped, very poorly trained, and are mostly just a bunch of drunken locals that also have Russian passports. They are not military capable of any attempt by Ukraine to shut them down. In fact, we know that Budanov, head of Ukrainian military intelligence, has been wanting to deal with the Transnistria issue in a more kinetic way, we can say. Assassination, military intervention. And the Moldovans said, no, we don't want to do that. It's not necessary. But if the Transnistrians are now wanting to keep pushing on this, by Transnistrians, I mean the mafia. It's literally just the Russian mafia that runs Transnistria. It is a mafia pseudo-state there. If they really want to push this issue, well, there are some military commanders in Ukraine that are more than happy to settle it. And if Russia keeps pushing in Moldova, the Moldovan authorities might change their minds. The worth of that action. Because while all this is going on, while Russia is essentially threatening to invade Moldova, the Moldovan authorities are saying that once again, the pro-Russian elements within Moldovan politics are attempting a coup. Alon Shor, the kind of leader of the pro-Russian forces in Moldova, nobody knows where he is right now, I don't think. He is also Israeli, so he had spent a lot of time in Israel in exile, though has since left Israel. And he's been a kind of continuous threat to the Moldovan state. This has happened last year as well, where the Moldovans were warning of a potential coup by Shor loyalists that never happened. This is yet another one of these parallels between Moldova and Ukraine, where Shor is kind of taking the Yanukovych role of if Russia is able to successfully intervene in Moldova, he would be installed as its leader. And the democracy that they've really been taking a lot of strides in recent years in order to strengthen and build will be destroyed, just like Russia wanted to destroy Ukrainian democracy, though. Lots and lots of parallels between Moldova and Ukraine right now. Again, with the exception that Moldova doesn't have to share a border with Russia. Is anything going to come of all of this? I have my severe doubts. The Shor coup failed last year, or at least to the point where it didn't even really begin to manifest itself too publicly. Whatever forces were working behind the scenes in order to make that happen were shut down before they could accomplish anything. And like I said, the military forces in Transnistria are entirely worthless. So any kind of attack emanating out of Transnistria is impossible. And any actions that Russia would take, they would first have to take Odessa in order to do, which, looping backwards, would involve French military intervention if Macron told the truth about that. So the Transnistrians are in zero position to act on this. The Russians are in zero position to act on this, but it is still an elevation of rhetoric that does need to be very carefully monitored, because this elevation, when it was being done against Ukraine, was not heated like it was supposed to have. Anyway, that rounds off our episode for this week. This episode, like I said, was mostly just about European news, so that leads plenty of more things to talk about in later episodes on the military front, really wanting to put something together for the issue of Russia using foreign recruits. That's my project at the moment. But if you would like to learn more about Ukraine, get some links to reliable charities you can give to for both humanitarian and military purposes, please go to the link in the description. There's a link tree there with a list of resources. If you would like to support Ukraine more broadly, I would also suggest that you call your congresspeople and especially in the House of Representatives, ask them to sign the discharge petition to put the Ukraine aid bill to a vote. If you'd like to support Ukraine Without Hype, please tell your friends about us, like us, share us on social media, get the word out. And if you'd like to support us financially, you can go to patreon.com/UkraineWithoutHype. And now I'd like to thank our wonderful patrons. So thank you very much to Deborah Grazer, Randy McNerlin, the voices in my head are from Big Pharma, David Shepard, Giorgio, Ivana Kokoratskaya, Michael Druker, Anna Karen Person, Anonymous, Dennis Napalm, Devi, Dimitri Litvin, Etienne, James Burke, Jan, Janara, Benny Louise, Kevin Alberton, Marguerite, Michael Wickman, Mike Perrone, PLM, Shieldwall, Silas Frank, T. Bart, Vivek, Adam Poppenheimer, Aiden McDonald, Alex Strochmal, Anastasia, Barbara, Captain Technical, Chris Bennington, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Emily Bavona, Francois, Grace Krause, Had to Laugh, Jacob Holm, James Wise, Jared Bradley, Jerd, Julia Lindsay, Laura De Leon, Levy Grove, Marianne, Matt Miller, Melissa Caselco, Anonymous, Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, RDK, Sanjay, Scott Berry, Scott Gengris, Scott Tokaryuk, Stuart Akers, Subtle Knife, Thomas Sobiek, Veronica, Victoria Leontineva, and Wandering Lens. Thank you all so much to make this podcast possible. So until next week, Slava Ukraini!